from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a new memo went out from the Department of Justice designed to clarify its policy on medical marijuana. The memo calls marijuana a dangerous drug and threatens to enforce the law against those involved in the business of cultivation or distribution of cannabis. The new memo also appears to run counter to a 2009 memo called the Ogden Memo, which states that federal resources will not be inefficiently used to prosecute those in clear compliance with state medical marijuana laws. As part of KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting's Republic of Cannabis series, we look at what this new Obama administration memo means for California. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In 2009, then-Deputy Attorney General David Ogden released a memo stating that the federal government would stay out of enforcement with respect to those in, quote, clear and unambiguous compliance, end of quote, with state medical marijuana laws. A recently released memo by Deputy Attorney General James Cole calls marijuana a dangerous drug, and the Department of Justice is now saying marijuana dispensers and licensed growers in states with medical marijuana laws can face prosecution for violating federal drug and money laundering laws and threatening enforcement against those who cultivate and distribute marijuana. 16 states have legalized medical marijuana and the District of Columbia, and over 1,000 dispensaries in California sell medical marijuana to people who possess recommendations for the drug from a doctor. In this morning's opening forum hour, as part of KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting's Republic of Cannabis series, we focus our attention on what all this means for California. Joining us in studio is Michael Montgomery, KQED Radio News and California Watch reporter. And welcome to the program, Michael.
Good morning, Michael.
Good to have you here. Well, this is sort of a tale of two memos, as I tried to outline in the introduction. Let's see if we can break this down. I mean, from clear and unambiguous compliance, we get to, I guess, what they're attempting to clarify as different from that?
Yeah, the debate really is about whether or not there's been a policy shift with the administration. One argument holds that there hasn't been a shift, that this is a clarification, but the bottom line remains the same, and that is individuals, people who are seriously ill and are using medical marijuana, do not need to fear prosecution by the feds. However, you get beyond that. Operators, people who own businesses, what have you, there could be prosecuted, and the feds are being clear. They're not saying who they're going to prosecute, but there's an important line in the new memo. I mean, it's quite clear. It says persons who are in the business of cultivating, selling, or distributing marijuana, and those who knowingly facilitate such activities, are in violation of the Controlled Substances Act, regardless of state law. So state law is not a protection. There were medical marijuana supporters who were hoping this new memo would give them some kind of an assurance that as long as they're in compliance with state law, they would be safe. That's not what the memo says. And again, there's a debate about whether it's that different from the Ogden memo from 2009.
Can we infer that the catalyst to this was that there was a lot of growing pot for, well, commercial purposes, whatever, medical marijuana or doctors' recommendations that were abusing perhaps what should have been legitimate recommendations?
Well, we all know there's been a lot of pot grown in California for many years. I think the way I see it is you have two things going on. There's more states adopting medical marijuana laws. And in California, the industry has grown to such a degree that it's grown beyond the legal regulatory framework that was created when Prop 215 was passed. And so counties and cities realize that they need to step up to the plate and regulate and even license growing. And that, again, starts creating tension with the feds when you talk about licensing large-scale growing. And interesting, this point about facilitation is significant because earlier this year, the feds warned the city of Oakland that if they went ahead with these large industrial pot farms, city officials themselves could be facing criminal liability for facilitating the production of an illegal drug.
So Oakland got the first memo on this, didn't they?
They did indeed. It started in Oakland, and memos from U.S. attorneys have gone to officials in other states. So whether or not there's a policy shift, there is growing tension between the medical marijuana states and the feds. And I anticipate that there will be more activity on the part of the feds in the U.S. and California because, A, there's just so much marijuana produced here. The size of the industry, you have some operators, dispensary owners who are operating quite large facilities. So I think the tension is going to increase.
And one thing that has set this off perhaps is that federal officials believe that some physicians, as I sort of alluded to before, are helping facilitate illegal export to other states. In fact, we have a Fresno case, right? Let's talk about that.
Right. Well, this is a case in which growers in Fresno County, growing very openly, were able to cultivate large amounts of marijuana under the guise of medical marijuana laws. They actually had doctors' recommendations posted at these gardens, which the doctors recommended 90 plants per patient, which is quite a large number. And what the Fresno County Sheriff's Office found is they actually followed that marijuana out of state all the way to Boston, where it was sold to a Jamaican street gang. That's a kind of abuse that certainly medical marijuana supporters don't want to see. There just is so much marijuana grown here. The prices have dropped in California. If you're willing to take the risk and move it out of state, you can make a lot more money. So that is something the feds talk about a lot, diversion. They're not satisfied with the way California's dealing with that. And that does give them leverage to really go after some of these operators.
Talking about using 215 as a shield, essentially, aren't they?
That's right. And again, medical marijuana supporters will say, look, you had illegal bootleggers of alcohol. That doesn't mean, even after prohibition, that doesn't mean medical marijuana is necessarily the problem. The problem is perhaps regulations. And ironically, you have a situation where medical marijuana supporters are pushing for tighter regulations, where paradoxically, the thrust of some of these feds' letters is warning against regulating and licensing. So it's a very curious situation.
Talking again with Michael Montgomery, who's here with us in studio, a reporter for KQED Radio News and California Watch. Some are saying actually California needs a statewide registry. Patients, of course, are fearful, and many of them wouldn't sign up for this, but there is no database to track doctors, their recommendations, or their patients.
No, and doctors are actually protected under 215. They have a certain degree of immunity for issuing medical marijuana recommendations. Again, if you go back to that period when doctors and others were under a lot of pressure from the feds, you can understand those protections. Again, the issue here is that the statewide regulations are vague at best. Now, what we've seen in other states, for example, Colorado, is a much tighter series of regulations that really do try to address some of the problems that we see in California. California was the first state to legalize this. We're always the trendsetters, and sometimes it doesn't quite go as well as you hope for.
But we could, under state medical laws, under the state medical board, actually. There is the authority to take licenses away from doctors who are essentially, working around marijuana laws.
And there have been some doctors who've lost their licenses. What some people would argue is that there's such a problem with over-prescribing other drugs, painkillers and what have you, that the medical board has its hands full with that, whereas marijuana isn't quite as kind of a toxic drug in that way. You do have this danger of drug traffickers, if you will, taking advantage of the system, and that's what we've seen. How large of a problem that is a little unclear. A lot of the illegal pot growers, out in the national forests, they're not bothering with any kind of a cover. They're doing it, completely illegally. So the medical board has tried to go after a few doctors, but there haven't really been that many cases.
Just give us a little brief about what happened in Oakland, because the mayor and Oakland officials were really ready to move forward in a major way in terms of getting more tax revenue.
Well, it wasn't just that. So Oakland last summer passed an ordinance that would have licensed four industrial pot farms. The argument was the realist argument. So much marijuana is grown in Oakland, like in San Francisco and other places. Why not license it? Why not try to get it out of people's basements and bedrooms and bring it into some industrial facilities that will be safer? You can test the product, and you can tax it. Oakland was anticipating millions of dollars in tax revenue. The ordinance, as it was originally written, would have allowed Oakland to sell pot grown in Oakland to any dispensary in the state. So Oakland really would have been a huge production center. The feds took one look at that and immediately started warning the Oakland City Attorney and eventually delivered this letter February 1st of this year. And Oakland backed off of that ordinance. They've submitted a new ordinance, and we will see whether that is kosher with the U.S. Attorney's Office or not.
Well, we're going to talk with a couple of other people who may or may not give us a view of kosher or unkosher here. Steve D'Angelo is with us from up in Stevenson, Washington. He's a founder and executive director of Harborside Health Center. They're a city-licensed medical cannabis dispensary in Oakland, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. We also have McGregor Scott with us. He's a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California during the George W. Bush administration. Currently, he's a partner at Orrick, Herrington & Sutcliffe Law Firm in Sacramento, and he's with us from the state capitol. McGregor Scott, good to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, let me actually begin with you, because from your perspective, this isn't really a change. This is just, as the government says, or as the Department of Justice says, a clarification, huh?
Well, when the Ogden memo was issued in 2009, my immediate reaction was that it really was no change from the practical policy that had been adopted by the four United States attorneys in California during the Bush administration. And what I mean by that is we focused our enforcement efforts, both the DEA and then in turn the prosecutions brought by the U.S. attorneys, on large-scale operations that were essentially openly selling marijuana and making profits in doing so behind the guise of 215. So in my mind, the Ogden memo really simply, in practical terms, put into writing what was in effect already during the Bush administration. This concept that the feds are going to swoop down and prosecute a grandmother with terminal cancer who has three plants growing in her backyard is a complete and has been a complete fiction. The federal government faces the very real reality of limited resources, people, money, and equipment, and as a result must focus its enforcement efforts on the most egregious offenders. Now, the Cole memo that's come out last week really simply states, again, the practical realities, which are that, number one, it is a violation of federal law, marijuana, period. End of conversation. And that law was passed by the Congress. Maybe 5 or 6 years ago, there was an effort made in the House of Representatives to reschedule marijuana away from Schedule I. That effort was resoundingly defeated. So you have the legislative branches held. This is a crime. In the Raich case, the whole matter went before the United States Supreme Court, which ruled this is a crime. It is constitutional. There's nothing in question about that. So the two other branches of the federal government have issued very clear direction that this is a federal crime. It is now up to the executive branch to enforce that law. And the executive branch, as I've already mentioned, must focus its efforts, must, because of limited resources, really zero in on the most egregious offenders. That's what we did in the Bush administration, and I'm confident that that's what they're doing in the Obama administration. So there really is the net effect on the ground, I think, is nil.
Well, this is, in other words, I'm also extrapolating from what you're saying, a violation of the Controlled Substance Act, regardless of state law or what state law says. So this
right.
clarifies the policy. It's not a new policy.
Right.
On the other hand, there was an assumption that President Obama promised to end raids. In fact, it was a campaign pledge of his. And this new memo offers guidance, but as many see it, it shifts gears.
Well, I think... Candidly, as in many areas, President Obama has found that campaign promises are different once you actually get into office and have to govern. And what the Ogden memo did, unfortunately, my opinion, the only thing that really kept marijuana, medical marijuana, in check in any way in California was the specter of federal investigation and prosecution. It was the finger in the dike. When the Ogden memo came out, there was this, I think, widespread belief that all of a sudden the feds had been called off, and it was just a free game. And what you saw in the months and years since then is just a manifest spike in the number of cannabis clubs, the growth and distribution of marijuana as seen by what the city of Oakland started to contemplate. It just absolutely manifestly took off. And so the Cole memo, I think, is sort of an effort to put a check on that, to say that the specter of federal prosecution does continue to exist, and the law will be enforced in appropriate cases, which typically are going to involve, as I say, massive grow sites, the sale of marijuana for profit, and that's what the Cole memo was intended to do.
And again, McGregor Scott's with us from Sacramento, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California during the George W. Bush administration, and we can expect Attorney General Eric Holder to release a letter soon which will presumably clarify this more. I think that's right, isn't it, Michael Montgomery?
Well, I was expecting Eric Holder to issue a letter. It seems as though the Cole memo is the letter. That is the statement from the Justice.
It's the letter of the law, so to speak, at this point. Let's hear what Steve D'Angelo has to say about this. Again, he's founder and executive director of Harborside Health Center, which is a city-licensed medical cannabis dispensary in Oakland. He's with us from Stevenson, Washington, and I think outrage is the word you used to describe your response to this Cole memo, huh, Steve D'Angelo?
Well, you know, Michael, I think that McGregor is absolutely right, that the Cole memo was intended to suppress the legal regulated medical cannabis industry, which I think is frankly an absurd position. The Obama administration is saying it's okay, or at least they will tolerate patients using this medicine, but anybody who supplies it to them in a legal regulated way is a subject of prosecution. Well, if the legal medical cannabis industry were closed down or even suppressed, what happens is patients will not stop using this medicine. They'll just buy it on the underground market, in a place where it's not laboratory tested, where there's not security, where there's no background checks on the operators, where there's no taxes. Does the Obama administration really saying that they would prefer patients to purchase medicine on the criminal underground market?
That's the message that you feel is coming across. Yeah.
That's the message that I'm hearing, certainly.
And are you also feeling that the government is saying you can use but you can't buy legally? Something along those lines?
Well, you know, what they've said is they're not going to make patients a target of prosecution, but that anybody who supplies patients will be a target of prosecution. You know, recently we had the first professionally prepared study of the medical cannabis industry, the legal industry released, the Sea Change Report, which found that there's $1.7 billion in the legal medical cannabis industry today. That's $1.7 billion that's been sucked away from the cartels, away from the criminal underground. It's produced tens of thousands of legal jobs, and already in Colorado and California, hundreds of millions of dollars of tax revenue. Do we really want to send that $1.7 billion back into the hands of the cartels?
You're also concerned about the effect that this is going to have on the prison population? Why?
I'm not sure that that's a concern. It's not a concern that I've articulated. It would all depend on what the Obama administration did with this policy.
Well, presumably they'd be prosecuting more people, putting more people in prison, and we already
have. Well, yeah, look, it just gets down to the question of whether this is an appropriate use of limited law enforcement resources when you have a situation in many, many states where a majority of either the legislature or the voters have approved medical cannabis for the federal government to be using resources that could be used against terrorists or violent criminals to go after people who are supplying patients in full compliance with state law.
So even if you're targeted over there at Harborside Health Center, you're standing firm. You're not changing at all.
Yeah, you know, once a person like myself has seen what this medicine does for patients, it's not really something you can stop doing. This is a absolutely critical medicine for many, many patients who are in deep suffering.
Let me go back to Michael Montgomery just to catch us up on things. Arizona officials are taking U.S. government to court on this to see if residents and state employees are protected from federal prosecution.
Right. And it's unclear what the motivations are for the governor of Arizona. But this is, I think, one of the things to watch and one of the elements that's really fairly new. And that is the question of local jurisdictions or states choosing to regulate and arguably trying to get control of this. Will the feds really go after them on that? I mean, it's such a curious situation. We're following the situation in Mendocino County. They are licensing medical marijuana growers. That, at least based on these memos we've been seeing from the Justice Department, is facilitation of drug trafficking. Will the feds go after them if Oakland moves ahead with their program? Will the Justice Department target them? And what you hear, and I think McGregor Scott suggested this, that they'll focus limited resources on the most egregious. But the law is supposed to be consistent so that if, in fact, you're saying to counties or cities, you can't license marijuana production, then are you going to let one county do it and kind of get away with it, or are you going to try to be consistent? And I think that's something that the four U.S. attorneys in California are really going to be looking at.
They're going to have to grapple with that. There's also, it'd be remiss if I didn't mention, a bill that's been introduced by Barney Frank and Ron Paul, so it's a bipartisan bill, that would remove marijuana from the list of federally controlled substances. It would give states really complete enforcement power of laws governing pot. Seems like a long shot, but any possibilities along those lines from your perspective?
I don't think so. McGregor Scott mentioned an effort to downgrade, if you will, marijuana from a Schedule I a drug. And now Schedule I means there's no medical purpose for it. I mean, it's alongside LSD. There's been a push to get it, you know, downgraded to a Schedule III or Schedule IV, which would then be sold in pharmacies, what have you. I don't see the political support for any of those efforts. It does seem that the push is going to continue to come from the states.
Well, let me open the phone lines. I'd like to hear what listeners have to say. Let me just give out the phone number, and then we'll hear from you, Steve. Our phone number is available to you now if you'd like to join this conversation. In fact, we cordially invite you to participate. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls, and you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post your questions and comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Steve D'Angelo, I think that was your voice, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't, Michael.
No, it was McGregor Scott. Sorry, yeah.
I just wanted to touch on this this concept of distribution or provision of marijuana to people who are in possession of a recommendation. One of the fundamental candidly don't know the first thing about the law in Washington, so I can't speak to that. But what here in California, one of the absolute fundamental problems from day one has been that Prop 215 did not create a vehicle by which people could lawfully come into possession of marijuana. There was no distribution system that was created by the proposition. So that's one of the fundamental issues that law enforcement and people who have recommendations have struggled with from day one. There was follow-on legislation that created the concept that collectives or co-ops could be, and in fact were the only lawful method by which patients could receive medical marijuana. So that's the state of the law in California. Co-ops and cooperatives, that position was articulated by then Attorney General Jerry Brown in a position paper issued to law enforcement. So that's one method. That's sort of the authorized approved method.
All right, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Stay tuned. This is Forum. We're talking about a new memo on medical marijuana policy. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're focusing on a new memo on medical marijuana policy. The Department of Justice issued the new memo to federal prosecutors, further clarifying from their point of view its policy on medical marijuana and calling medical marijuana a dangerous drug. Calling marijuana a dangerous drug, I should say. The memo threatened enforcement actions against people in the business of cultivating and distributing marijuana. It contrasts in many people's minds and even reneges on a 2009 memo which said that federal resources should not be used to prosecute those in clear and unambiguous compliance with state medical marijuana laws. We're following up on KQED's Republic of Cannabis series done in conjunction with the Center for Investigative Reporting, looking at what this means, particularly for California. Michael Montgomery with us in studio has been following this and reporting on it for KQED Radio News and California Watch, and McGregor Scott with us from the state capitol is a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California during the George W. Bush administration, currently a partner at Orrick, Herrington & Sutcliffe Law Firm in Sacramento. And Steve D'Angelo is with us from Stevenson, Washington. He's founder and executive director of Harborside Health Center, a city-licensed medical cannabis dispensary in Oakland. And before I go to calls and emails, Steve D'Angelo, I wanted to bring you back in here just to get your response to the fact that there probably are a number of dispensers who are using Prop 215 as a cover. There is, I suppose, what you call bad apples or abusers as far as what's being dispensed and what's being distributed and for commercial profit, all those kinds of things, I think you'd concede. So notwithstanding what you mentioned as job loss and black market and all of that, don't you want to see some of these people perhaps stop from what they're doing, from giving the rest of you a bad name?
Oh, absolutely, and I agree 100% with McGregor about the flaw in 215 and the need for comprehensive statewide regulation in California, just as we have in Colorado. This is why the Cole memo is so egregious, because it's clearly a bow across the shot of states like Colorado that are attempting to create the system of regulation that we really need to make sure that there's no leakage of legal cannabis to the underground market. So I 100% support a system of comprehensive statewide regulation, and it is important to understand that there were several attempts moving towards this type of regulation, not only in Colorado, but also in Arizona, also in Washington State. It was those attempts to regulate and control medical cannabis that led to the issuance of this memo, and it was intended to frustrate those efforts, and this is why I say that it's going to drive patients onto the underground criminal market.
And before we hear from our listeners, McGregor Scott is talking a little bit with Michael Montgomery about how this has become even more complicated by the IRS audit. Can I get you to comment on that?
The IRS audit. I'm sorry. You caught me off guard on that one. What's the IRS audit?
Michael Montgomery.
Well, it's actually be interesting to hear from Steve D'Angelo, because the IRS has been auditing a number of dispensaries, and there's a very – it's, again, one of these conflicts with federal law, in this case, some serious issues with federal tax law in terms of business write-offs. And so, you know – dispensaries are feeling pressure on that front and, could owe millions in back taxes because of it.
Yeah, you want to comment, Steve D'Angelo?
Sure. The issue in the IRS audits is a clause in the IRS code called 280E. 280E provides that any drug trafficking organizations may not deduct normal and usual business expenses from their gross revenue, like rent, payroll, insurance, etc., and instead are taxed on their gross revenues. So if 280E were to be applied very strictly and bluntly, it would result in the closure of every medical cannabis dispensary in the country.
Let me bring our callers in, and we'll begin, Joseph, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for the show. Very important topic. I just want to say that I'm disappointed in the Obama administration. And I voted for Obama. I'm a fan of Obama. But to classify marijuana as a dangerous drug, I just don't believe it. I know many professionals, including myself, who smoke marijuana. We enjoy it. I believe it's safer than alcohol. And you don't, when's the last time you heard of a college kid going out and smoking too many joints and dying as opposed to drinking too many shots of whiskey? And so I just want to say that I'm disappointed that we're even having this debate. It's unnecessary. And yes, I do understand that in the current laws, there are some flaws that we can work on. But I do believe that it is a good way for us to get revenue and just help our economy out. Thanks.
Okay, we thank you for that, and we'll just move along to more of your calls here. Other opinions like that, but also questions that you have. And Keith is joining us with a question. Hi, Keith. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Michael. This is a question for any of your guests, which I'll take the answer offline. it seems to me it's, from what I've heard, that it's relatively easy to get a prescription for medical marijuana. And I'm wondering what percentage of those prescriptions are actually for verifiable medical reasons, and what percentages are just for people who found a doctor who's sympathetic and who wants to get high.
Okay, thank you for the question. What do we know on that score, Michael Montgomery?
Well, I was going to defer to Steve D'Angelo. I'm curious what his impression is.
We'll hear from him, but let's hear from the reporter first.
There's a very wide a category of illnesses or maladies that one can use to get a doctor's recommendation. It's not a prescription. In fact, it's pretty much up to the judgment of the doctor. It's very easy to get a recommendation. I got a recommendation because for our series, we had to go cover this cannabis expo at the Cow Palace. And, I do have knee pain. That was enough for the doctor to give me a recommendation, which allowed us to film inside the expo. I didn't smoke pot inside the expo.
Well, and you didn't inhale it either, I understand. But Steve D'Angelo, there is this perception that there is a good deal of, leniency, perhaps even promiscuity when it comes to doctors giving recommendations for use of marijuana?
Well, first of all, I think it varies from state to state quite markedly. California certainly has the most generous allowance, which basically allows doctors to write medical cannabis recommendations for any use which they think is appropriate, rather than a list of specified conditions. But we do have a mechanism that is set up to address these issues. It's the Medical Board of California. And, often I hear law enforcement officials making estimates of the number of legitimate recommendations, and I just don't think that either they or I have the medical training necessary to look at any individual and say, okay, 20%, 30%, 40% of the recommendations are valid and the rest aren't. I think that that's a determination that really requires a degree of medical training. I recall in the early days of Harborside, we had a young man come in who wanted to buy an unusually large quantity of edible cannabis, and we sat down, talked to him about it, investigated to make sure he wasn't diverting to the illegal market, and found out that this apparently healthy young man actually had leukemia and was going in for chemotherapy the next week. There's many examples like that.
What do you think on this score, McGregor Scott?
Well, I think the fundamental problem is that Prop 215 was presented to the voters as applying to persons with terminal cancer, AIDS wasting syndrome, glaucoma, those kinds of things. And the statute itself that was enacted includes a catch-all phrase which says, or any other illness for which marijuana provides relief. And I don't know of any other, let me rephrase that. I don't know of any FDA-approved prescriptive drug which includes such a broad, sweeping approval for usage. Drugs are approved by the FDA for specific articulated illnesses and purposes. And what we have in California because of that or any other illness for which marijuana provides relief is just an amazing, open-ended, anybody can get a card. I mean, it's that simple. You can walk into a doctor who will write these recommendations, pay your $50 or $100, and get a recommendation. And I think that's really one of the very fundamental flaws with 215. If it truly is going to be treated as a medicine, almost in a prescriptive sort of a way, it needs to be much more narrowly defined in terms of what illnesses fall under its guidelines. And that's one of the great frustrations, I think, for not just law enforcement, but for those who genuinely voted for Prop 215 with the best of intentions, that it has been used as just this open-ended means of acquiring any marijuana that you want for your own use.
And again, McGregor Scott was a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California during the George W. Bush administration. Some comments from many of you on the web. Let me read a few of them. Here's a listener who says, remember that former Oakland City Attorney John Russo warned the mayor and city council that the proposed industrial growers would be perceived as illegal by the federal government. The mayor and city council, particularly Councilmember Desley Brooks, took him to task for not doing his job. Russo turned out to be right, and right changing jobs from a city that wouldn't accept his legal advice. Another listener writes, this is just another example of how opposed to the democratic system the Obama administration is. The voters are speaking Obama, and they have spoken. Any federal agent acting under the 10th Amendment should be held for treason under Article 4 for adhering to enemies of the United States Constitution by acting outside the law to enforce personal belief instead of the will of the people. And Gerald puts on the web, I don't know what it means for California, but I think it means that Barack Obama is running for another term and is more concerned about the middle-class aged brow than the young. As a listener says, I hope one of your guests can provide some insight into the schedule level that marijuana is classified as and whether avenues should be explored to reduce it. Michael Montgomery.
Well, we talked about this earlier. I mean, marijuana is considered a Schedule I drug. That is something that was created back in the early 70s. As I said, alongside LSD, no medical use, period. And again, this is paradoxically that prevents, for example, a lot of research to go on with marijuana, because if you're going to do official research, you need a DEA license. They're very hard to come by.
Same with LSD and MDMA.
Exactly. So the argument, there's been a longstanding argument, and I think a lot of law enforcement I know would agree with this, that if you were to downgrade it to a Schedule II or Schedule III, you would actually be able to regulate it more tightly, because you wouldn't have recommendations, you would have prescriptions, and doctors need DEA licenses to get those prescriptions. Now, obviously, we have problems with prescription drugs being distributed. So that's the situation. As you said, there is some legislation pending, but I don't think it has much chance to get traction.
Is there a likelihood of a central database to track doctor recommendations or their patients?
Well, Steve might talk about that. The situation in Colorado, I understand, is creating some kind of a registry. People have been reluctant to have that in California, patients particularly worried about
privacy,
where it could go.
Yeah.
So we're stuck in the situation where we have an industry that's outgrown the sort of vague regulatory framework that was created under 215.
Well, let me go to actually more of our calls, because the next listener has something for Steve, I think. Jane, you're on. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for this great program. I have two comments and questions. The first is directed, I think, primarily to Mr. D'Angelo. Those of us who've come in contact with medical cannabis, and I did so through a gravely ill father-in-law, find that at places like Harborside, the emphasis seems to be on marijuana, cannabis, which is grown indoors, which is really an environmental nightmare. It's part of the reason that people want to see more transparency. Growing indoors started in the 70s because of the pressure from the federal government. There's no way to grow indoors without having the risk of fire and using all kinds of pesticides, whereas cannabis that's grown outdoor has a much lighter environmental footprint. And those of us who've wanted to buy, for instance, an edible for an ill relative, don't want to buy a medicine which has been grown with pesticides. So I'd like Mr. D'Angelo to speak about why it is that dispensaries seem to favor only indoor grown. My second comment is to the panel at large. We found that Marinol was relatively easy to obtain, but we found that it was an isolate, that it only took one part, the THC, of the medical cannabis, and it's relatively ineffective. I found it ineffective following chemotherapy. My father-in-law certainly found it ineffective. So I'd like maybe a little bit of light cast on what is available in terms of Marinol. And finally, Michael, a medicine like Vicodin is just prescribed. You can get it so easily for pain, for a wide variety of pain, and yet it destroys the liver and kidneys. So the idea that there is no other medicine which has such a broad range of applications is really not entirely correct. But I'd like to listen on the air, and thank you again.
Thank you. Let me begin, if I may, Steve D'Angelo, in asking about the indoor dispensaries that she brought up and pesticides and environmental concerns.
Well, she's absolutely right. It takes about 200 pounds of coal to produce 1 pound of cannabis indoors. We need to take a look at the history here. In the 1970s, you saw increasing federal and state enforcement efforts on outdoor cannabis cultivation. That's why cannabis cultivation moved indoors. It's much easier to hide a garden indoors, obviously, than outdoors. There were massive helicopter overflights in Northern California, and thousands of growers moved indoors. Now, as we're beginning to see the creation of a legal cannabis cultivation system, like in Mendocino County, where the sheriff is licensing growers who are providing medicine to legitimate dispensaries, we will be able to increase the amount of outdoor cannabis that's being grown. We'll be able to get the production out from under the lamps and back into the sun. I should mention, however, that at Harborside Health Center, we test all of our medicine in a laboratory, and we always have outdoor cannabis that's available. I'd like to mention just briefly the issue of the isolate of THC. That's a great point, and it's one of the reasons that many patients prefer whole plant cannabis or whole plant extracts of cannabis, because there's about 65-plus different unique cannabinoids in the plant. All of them provide relief for various different things, and most patients find a whole plant extract much better than an isolate.
So can you shed some light on Marinol specifically?
Sure. Marinol is pure THC. THC is the element in cannabis which gets you high. It has medical effect, but it's not the only element in cannabis that has medical effect. For example, there's another called CBD. CBD is medically effective but has no psychoactivity. It doesn't get you high at all. And for that reason, we have begun to develop CBD-rich forms of cannabis, which give patients the medical effect that they're looking for with a greatly decreased level of psychoactivity. That's something we also carry at Harborside.
And McGregor Scott, I'd like to get your slant on what the caller brought up as a final point there, just about the reasoning, particularly from, well, Justice Department, or as someone who was a part of that world during the Bush administration, of, you know, concern over Vicodin, how easy it is to get and how much more deleterious it can be.
Well, I think this comes back to the fundamental concept of if in fact this marijuana is going to be treated as a medicine, I think the entire system, everyone, law enforcement, patients, would benefit from a regulation of that along the lines of prescriptions. I think it's a little disingenuous just to point the finger at Vicodin and say, oh, that's the huge problem, when the fundamental structure, at least in California, around medical marijuana in terms of how much, how can it be acquired, what illnesses does it apply to, are just completely open-ended questions that create nothing but problems for everyone involved in this situation. I did want to touch, if I could, briefly on the environmental issues that were raised by the caller. And I know, I think Michael touched on this point earlier about the big grows that are being done up in the national forests and the national parks, principally by Mexican-based organizations. But no one should have any question about the environmental damage that is being done as a result of those operations, the clear cutting in national forests, the stream diversion, the pesticides, the chemicals. I've been there. I've hiked in with the rangers and the law enforcement folks, and you sit there and you see a bag of pesticides with a skull and crossbones on it with Spanish writing on it, a pesticide which is banned in the United States but has been brought in for the purposes of growing marijuana in the national forest. So the environmental damage is not limited to indoor grows.
You mentioned, since you mentioned Mexican involvement, how much of this perhaps is even behind what we're seeing now? Because the drug problem has grown so out of control as far as violence coming from the South and from Mexico that certainly there's a great deal of more federal concern in working with the Mexican government. You want to speculate on that, McGregor Scott?
Well, I think I'm not aware of any studies that have attempted to draw a linkage between these Mexican-based grows in the national forests, national parks, and the cannabis clubs. But I think it would be naive to assume that there isn't some connection. The number of holders of recommendations of medical marijuana in this state have just absolutely mushroomed, and that demand has to be met somewhere. So there's no doubt in my mind, based on the years that I spent as U.S. attorney looking at those issues, that there is a linkage here between supply and demand, between those things. And the concept that it's a harmless drug and nobody is hurt by this and all these sorts of things, I mean, these drugs are being purchased and money is flowing. And we need to be cognizant of the fact that much of what the Mexicans are dealing with and have dealt with over the last several years in their country is a direct result of the demand for illegal drugs, not just marijuana, but cocaine and methamphetamine and heroin in this country are fueling the drug cartels and the violence that is taking place in that country.
Let me go to some emails. Here's one that sees things from a different point of view than what you just expressed, McGregor Scott. This is Jay who writes, marijuana cannot be a dangerous drug. If it was, then according to government estimates, about 25 million users consuming about 14 million pounds of marijuana would show up in our emergency rooms or doctor's offices. They do not. You cannot OD on it. So why persecute pot smokers and fill our jails at taxpayer expense? Decriminalize marijuana. The key to reducing drug use is to take the money out of it. No profit, no incentive to create a market. Making it illegal creates a high-priced market for well-armed Mexican gangs to supply us. The money finances crime, grist for the police, bad for everybody else. Another listener writes, I know a number of persons who swear by marijuana to relieve their physical symptoms. They are active promoters of medical marijuana, but of those persons, all but one have been longtime users, predating any medical situation. I've come across only rarely persons who never used marijuana previously and now use it for physical symptoms. My observation, promoters of medical marijuana are invariably longtime pot smokers. That's from Ralph. And another listener, Bill, writes, Northern California grass is the best in the world, and we don't trust big business to be good stewards of the strains of the land. Any legalization should start with releasing pot prisoners, not by unleashing more free market madness in the name of raising revenue. We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Oakland. Fred, you're on.
Hi. I'm a patient and as well as a healthcare provider, and I've found that, and I don't look unhealthy, and when I go into the dispensaries, they kind of give me the broad wink, and when I tell them I'm there for real symptoms, they kind of do a double take. And I find that this kind of loose-knit thing is very confusing to the outside world. I don't know of any other drug that we prescribe that the patient gets to choose the dosage. It's confusing to the outside world because we all look like a bunch of scammers trying to get in under the legal limit here.
Steve D'Angelo, can I get a comment from you, especially in light of that email we just received from that observation, anecdotal though it may be, that many of these people were pot users previous and just like using pot for whatever their symptoms may be?
Yeah, I think that you know, a lot of the earliest patients were people who had previous experience with cannabis and they felt comfortable with it. At Harborside, our most rapidly growing patient segment is what we call cannabis-naive patients, patients who have had no experience with cannabis prior to the time that their doctor recommended it to them. It's one of the reasons that we developed the CBD-rich cannabis medicines and to provide those patients with the medical effect that they're looking for without as much psychoactivity, which they tend to see as an undesirable side effect.
Let me bring another caller on. That's Brian, who's joining us from Durham, North Carolina, known more for its tobacco probably than its cannabis. Welcome, Brian. You're on the air.
Thanks. I'm just curious, what's it going to take for it to become decriminalized or legalized? One of your guests said that there was no traction on the bill, but I mean, the people are supposed to be represented, and it just confuses me. I don't mean to sound naive, but aren't the officials supposed to be, you know, representing us? And I think the consensus is that it needs to be made decriminalized. So, I mean, what is it going to take, is I guess what I'm saying.
Well, there are a lot of politics we're talking about here. But, Michael Montgomery, you want to opine on this or just speculate as to what it would take?
Well, you know, there has
political
been—
political will, to begin with.
There has been, you know, developments on decriminalization in California. Possession of marijuana is now just a fine. Below a misdemeanor, and other states are moving in that direction. You know, I tell you, you talk to federal officials, even who might personally be sympathetic to the legalization argument, they'll dial back and tell you to read the Controlled Substances Act. It's not— these memos might be a little subject to interpretation. The Controlled Substances Act isn't, and it sort of locks in the federal government. Now, the argument there would be, okay, let's, you know, have Congress should step up and change that. Well, we're back to the original, what we talked about earlier, and that there just doesn't seem to be political support for that. So we're trapped in this sort of situation until there's real movement at the federal level. And again, I think the states will continue to take the initiative.
How do you read it, McGregor Scott? I mean, on the federal level.
I think what Michael just said is right. I don't think there's any political will certainly in the numbers that would be required to amend the Controlled Substances Act in both the Senate and the House for this to happen. And the reality of the situation, as I mentioned earlier, is that two of the three branches have one has passed this law, one has upheld its constitutionality, and it's up to the executive branch to enforce it.
Let me go on to more calls, and John joins us from El Cerrito. Morning, John. You're on the air.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question about the discrepancy between enforcement of the abuse of pharmaceutical drugs. I mean, certainly Vicodin, Oxycodone, Adderall have all been approved by the FDA, but there's still widespread abuse of those drugs, and you just don't hear about it as much as you hear about the prosecution of abuse of medical marijuana. I was just wondering, is that related to the influence of the pharmaceutical companies, the millions of dollars plow into campaign funds every year, et cetera? And I was hoping perhaps McGregor Scott might be able to comment on that.
Okay. McGregor Scott, it's to you.
Well, I think it's naive to underestimate the power of the pharmaceutical lobbyists in Washington. But the reality is, I think, twofold. Number one, if persons unlawfully possess prescriptive drugs, those people are prosecuted. As when I was a DA, we saw those cases on a regular basis. When I was U.S. attorney, when there were distribution rings, we brought those cases. So there is no distinction in that regard. What's a little different, though, I think, is in my experience, having tried a whole lot of jury trials as a prosecutor over the years, is that there tends to be a deference given to doctors who have prescribed a medication for someone. And candidly, a recommendation is not the same as a prescription by a credible doctor. So the reality of trying to bring those enforcement efforts and prosecution efforts is different in the prescriptive realm than it is with marijuana.
Well, that's going to bring us to a conclusion here. I want to thank McGregor Scott, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California during George W. Bush's administration, currently a partner at Orrick, Harrington & Sutcliffe. Thank you for joining us, McGregor Scott.
Thank you.
And thank you, Steve D'Angelo, founder and executive director of Harborside Health Center.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks.
And thanks to Michael Montgomery, reporter for KQED Radio News and California Watch. Thanks to our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.